So I'm supposed to talk tonight about the provisions of the recent Geneva Accord and offer some kind of analysis of its merits or demerits, which I would like to do, but it's hard not to do that in a void. It's hard not to do that without reference to the facts on the ground right now inside Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. And it's hard to relay these facts in the proper, dispassionate manner that we are supposed to expect from respectable commentators and panelists. But let's be serious. Should we really be dispassionate about military occupation, about settler pogroms, about apartheid and ethnic cleansing? Should we really be dispassionate when we talk about the latest journalist or UN worker or International Solidarity Movement volunteer or Palestinian school kid shot in the head by an Israeli military sniper? What about the latest incident of a Palestinian family crushed to death in their own home as it gets demolished to make room for the wall that Jackie was just talking about, or because their home's too close to what is an illegal Jewish-only colony, or simply because collective punishment is a routine part of the occupation itself? So I might get accused later on of hyperbole or bias or whatever for my choice of adjectives. Hopefully there won't be any of the obligatory, much abused and ridiculous charges of anti-Semitism that we often hear at these kinds of talks. For even suggesting that Zionism's National Liberation Project and Israel's purity of arms is more accurately described as a kind of a blood-soaked, all-too-typical form of European colonialism. So, before we get to the actual provisions and analysis of this latest so-called peace proposal, let's talk about some undisputed facts. Does anybody here actually know how many Palestinians have been killed since the Geneva Accord was first drafted and unveiled in mid-October? I mean, the last suicide bombing against Israeli civilians was on October 4th, when 19 people were brutally killed in a Haifa restaurant. And since then, the media has been characterizing things as this kind of period of calm, as it's wont to do, so that you and I might expect, or we might be excused for thinking that no one had died in the last 2.5 months on either side. That's what a period of calm should represent. But in reality, almost 100 Palestinians have been killed since October 4th, mostly civilians, including about 20 children. If we had a media and government that was remotely interested in reporting the facts on the ground, if we had a media that was remotely concerned about balance, we would know some of the names of these 100 dead, and we would have seen a story or two about the hobbies and the dreams and the aspirations of the children that the media sometimes reports in a kind of collateral damage fashion. And we would have seen some interviews with grieving parents, as they do in some of the European press and media. We'd know the name of Bashir Mohammed Ahmed Owais, a 27-year-old man from Balada refugee camp near Nablus, who died while in Israeli military custody just this past Monday, following reports of torture and medical negligence. Or we'd know the name and something maybe about the life of the 20-year-old student Kamla Al-Shuli, who was shot dead by Israeli soldiers just this very morning as she was on her way to Al-Najah University in Nablus. The media rightly gives us these kinds of stories, these kind of personal humanizing stories about Israeli civilians who are killed in terrorist attacks. But it's extremely rare in the Canadian and U.S. media to hear those kinds of that same kind of treatment about Palestinian victims or the same kinds of interviews with next of kin. This ongoing repression and violence against ordinary Palestinians ought to be an essential part of our understanding of the context behind the Geneva Accords. There are other facts on the ground which ought to help us judge the prospects for meaningful peace in the current climate. Since the great fanfare of the drafting of the Geneva Accord in mid-October, Israel has begun building yet another Jewish-only settlement or colony outside its borders in the midst of the Palestinian neighborhood of Jabal Mukabir near Jerusalem. It's being called Nof Zahav, which means golden landscape in Hebrew. Very nice, eh? And it's inside the Palestinian West Bank, part of an ongoing plan to complete a ring of colonies around Arab East Jerusalem, combined with the wall, that in effect cuts off the entire center of Palestinian economic and political and cultural and religious life. Arab East Jerusalem cuts it off completely from the rest of the population, making in and of itself, in my opinion, the whole concept of a viable Palestinian state into an increasingly bad joke. So having said all this, we have before us this much vaunted, much publicized peace proposal, and its opening preamble affirms the lofty goal of, quote, living in peaceful coexistence, mutual dignity and security based on a just, lasting, and comprehensive peace, end quote. It sounds wonderful. So we should hope that it's true. We should want it to be true. We should look into it and find out the facts, and if it seems plausible and genuine, we should lend our support. Not to mention throw a party. But how does one assess such a proposal, and shouldn't we be extra skeptical given the sheer number of peace proposals and agreements that have surfaced over the last 30 years, only to end in new explosions of violence? I don't need to remind everyone of all the previous hallucinations of everlasting peace and prosperity, from Oslo to Camp Dave, from Taba to the Roadmap. And don't forget the Mitchell and the Rogers and the Tenet plans, each one announced with great fanfare about the dawn of a new era. And shouldn't we also be skeptical, given the histories of the Geneva document's authors? The principal Israeli architect of the GA is Yossi Belin, the prime mover behind the secret talks that led to the Oslo Accords in 1993. He's also one half of the dynamic duo that came up with the Beilin-Abu Mazen proposals in October 1995, which later formed the basis for Camp David. And he was also a negotiator at the Taba talks in January 2001. According to Israeli scholar Tanya Reinhart, the Beilin-Abu Mazen plan was a, quote, shameful document that left all the settlements untouched. And Barak's Camp David proposal, according to her, was just a worsened version of the earlier plan, characterized by manipulative language and a conscious attempt, actually, to keep the details from the Palestinian people themselves. Other Israeli participants in the GA include Amram Mitzna, former Labor Party leader, as well as people like Amos Oz, the dovish novelist, and turned into beacon of Israeli self-righteousness. And of course, the principal Palestinian architects are no better. Yasser Abed Yirabo is a career PA figure and was the Minister of Culture and Information between 1994 and 2001. He's now being touted as basically a leading light of Palestine, the elusive partner for peace that Israelis have long lamented never existed. And he's busy touring Europe and the U.S. with much acclaim and getting published in the New York Times about the trials and tribulations of working for peace. In a Haaretz commentary from October 16th, Rabo's new buddy Mitzna asserted that the Palestinian negotiators of the GA represented, quote, an authentic, broad Palestinian leadership that enjoys the support both from the official Palestinian Authority leadership and from the activist leaders at street level, end quote. So why the sudden praise for a longtime PA functionary from a quasi-state institution that Israel has often described as terrorist? And is it true anyway? In what sense can Rabo be praised as an authentic and popular Palestinian leader? It seems clear to me from reading the text of the Geneva Accord that Rabo and other Palestinian negotiators are being praised precisely for abandoning the historical pillars of Palestinian national liberation and for abandoning the very clear affirmations of Palestinian collective and individual rights spelled out in international law, including but not limited to UN resolutions 194, 242, 338. Rabo is actually willing to sign his name to a document that forfeits the Palestinian right of return, affirmed in resolution 194. According to Mitzna, his Haaretz piece, this was the key point, quote, they gave up the right of return to the state of Israel, and a solid, stable Jewish majority was guaranteed, end quote. Well, as we will see, that's not the only thing Rabo and his similar PA cronies, including Arafat, are willing to concede on behalf of their people. But what has been the Palestinian response? How authentic and popular are the Geneva architects and the provisions themselves? Virtually every major Palestinian grassroots leader, intellectual, activist, as well as Palestinian human rights and solidarity groups, inside Israel-Palestine, as well as throughout the diaspora, has come out against the Geneva Accord. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights has attacked the GA, as well as Switzerland itself, for hosting and supporting the negotiations. The latter due to it being a high contracting party to the Fourth Geneva Convention. But the PCHR maintains that the new Geneva Accord, quote, legitimizes Israel's colonization and confiscation of Palestinian territory, rescinds the inherent human right of return of 5 million refugees, and is in breach of a range of Geneva conventions, such as those prohibiting population transfer into occupied territory, Article 49, Paragraph 6, which is a war crime under Additional Protocol 1, Article 85, 4A. Throughout the West Bank and Gaza, thousands of Palestinians from a range of backgrounds, political and religious perspectives, have taken to the streets in protest to denounce the GA, calling the signatories traitors. Contrary to Belin and Rabo's joint New York Times article, Palestinians who oppose the GA are not confined to Hamas and Islamic Jihad, which they explicitly stated in their article in order to discredit opposition. Key PLO figures like Abdullah al-Hurani, head of the PLO Refugees Department, has said, quote, let it be known that those participating in the Geneva Party don't represent us. Fatah official Assad Abu Shark called the signatories of the accord a handful of pigs, which is, I think, a more serious charge there than it is here. Palestinian activists in Rafah tried to block the Palestinian delegation to Geneva from leaving Gaza, shouting no to treason. And at a conference at Al-Najah University in Nablus, Palestine National Council member Taizir Nasrallah called the GA a, quote, treasonous document and explicitly warned, maybe even threatened, the PLO leadership that it would lose all legitimacy the moment it chooses to forsake the right of return. Palestinian member of Knesset, Azmi Bishara, has also denounced it. The list is pretty much endless, and I haven't even mentioned any Palestinian names from the majority of Palestinian commentators and organizations outside Israel, Palestine, and spread out in the diaspora, like Al-Auda, where basically 7 million out of the 10 million Palestinians actually live, and where support for the right of return is virtually universal. So how do we actually assess the worth of the Geneva Accord? In addition to talking about the actual facts on the ground and taking note of the ongoing process of colonization, annexation, and repression that is the occupation, all of which went on as normal when the dovish signatories and supporters of this new accord were actually inside the Israeli government. I think that's worth bearing in mind. In addition to this, and the fact that the rhetoric of new peace proposals has never really matched the policies pursued by both the Israeli and Palestinian elites, we need to keep in mind a few things. One is the fundamental asymmetry of the two parties. Like all previous peace proposals over the last 10 years, the latest accord must be understood first and foremost in terms of the asymmetry of power between the two sides, and the fact that the United States consistently backs Israel politically, economically, militarily, to the tune of $3 billion a year. The accord is also not even an official proposal, and yet it's received so much coverage. This is not a reason to reject it per se, but it must be kept in mind that Ariel Sharon has rejected it as, quote, the greatest mistake since Oslo, which he also opposed. And even the Labour Party has failed to formally endorse the plan, despite the Labour Party sort of records and the status of the actual authors of the document. Even Ehud Barak opposes the GA as being too generous to Palestinians, which should put the lie to his mythical generous offer at Camp David. But the important point in all this is that the Palestinian Authority, including Arafat, has stated that the accord is a positive development in marked contrast to the rest of the Palestinian population, while the Israeli government has actually attacked it. This may end up meaning that Palestinian concessions in this unofficial document regarding settlements, Jerusalem, the right of return, and so on, will likely or possibly become the starting point for future negotiations, even while the Israeli side doesn't consider it bound because it was written by private citizens, however illustrious. But this brings us finally to the actual content and provisions of the accord. Many progressive people, including many that I know in the Palestine solidarity and anti-occupation movements in Winnipeg and Montreal, seem to think that the Geneva Accord is different from past efforts. They seem to think that it is the best that can be achieved. We have to be realistic. And they think that Sharon's opposition to the GA proves that there must be something good about it. Even though Labour, the Labour Party, has actually been worse than Likud in terms of expanding settlements throughout the 90s. I don't know how I'm doing for time or how bored people are, but I mean, I could go through some of the provisions real briefly. There's a lot of lofty rhetoric in the preamble to this. It assumes a two-state solution, but what kind of state for the Palestinians? That's the question. It asserts that the signatories will, quote, conduct themselves in conformity with the norms of international law and the Charter of the United Nations. It says the UN resolutions 242 and 338 will kind of form the basis of where we're going here in the document. It will constitute, and the document's implementation will constitute the full implementation of these resolutions, it says, which most people would think would be a hopeful thing, considering 242 calls for the immediate and complete withdrawal of all settlers and soldiers from to within the pre-67 borders. So you'd think that would be a good thing. But then it goes on to basically outline provisions that completely violate those resolutions. It insists that the GA's implementation will, quote, settle all the claims of the parties. It's an end to the conflict provision. Basically, if the Palestinians sign this, there can be no further claims, no further complaints. It's an end to the conflict. And it pledges that both parties will not interfere in each other's internal affairs. Vows to establish, quote, robust modalities for security cooperation in order to, quote, end terrorism and violence against both peoples. It talks about setting up an implementation and verification group made up of the U.S., Russia, the EU, and the UN, and possibly other parties to enforce the GA and resolve disputes. And it talks about creating a multinational force to help monitor and enforce the provisions. multinational force that would only be positioned inside the Palestinian state, not inside the Israeli state. Borders in Article 4 claims to base all border adjustments in accordance with UN Resolution 242, with the possibility of reciprocal adjustments on a one-to-one basis. So Israel would annex certain lands that it has lots of settlers on, and then the Palestinians would gain land on a one-to-one ratio elsewhere inside Israel that would be annexed to the Palestinian state. Quality is not an issue in this. It's just a quantity thing. The GA claims to recognize and respect each other's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence, as well as the inviolability of each other's territory, including territorial waters and airspace. So there's all sorts of great-sounding things. Settlement withdrawal is a bit ambiguous in the document. It appears to leave most of the central West Bank settlements, especially in and around East Jerusalem, intact, which is basically the vast majority of settlers, and allows them to be annexed to Israel. It talks about the creation of a corridor that would be between Gaza Strip and the West Bank to allow Palestinians to travel. But this corridor will be, quote, under Israeli sovereignty, end quote, and will not disrupt Israeli transportation and will be built with defensive barriers along its entire length to ensure that no one can enter either side from the corridor. Israel will maintain troops in the Jordan Valley and military bases that it calls early warning stations in northern and central West Bank for an indefinite period of time, subject to perpetual renewal by the, quote, the party's consent. The Israeli Air Force is, quote, entitled to use the Palestinian sovereign airspace, end quote, for training purposes in perpetuity. Never mind that just like a few paragraphs back, it was talking about the inviolability of airspace. all Palestinian border crossings will have a joint PSF, Palestine Security Force, and multinational force monitoring teams. They'll have to, quote, prevent the entry into Palestine of any weapons, materials, or equipment that are in contravention of the GA. There's no corresponding provision relating to Israel. The document details that the Palestinian state can have no army and will be restricted from importing certain kinds of weapons and manufacturing certain kinds of weapons. Israel may maintain an unseen presence in various civilian transportation stations, like bus stations and so on and so forth, to monitor things inside the Palestinian state. Jerusalem. The parties will, quote, safeguard the character, holiness, and freedom of worship in Jerusalem, end quote. and, quote, respect the existing division of administrative functions. That's kind of an ambiguous statement. What could that mean? The existing division of administrative functions is that Israel occupies East Jerusalem and runs it. Article 6/5 talks about the Temple Mount compound, but highlights the, quote, unique religious and cultural significance of the site to the Jewish people, not to Muslims as well. Goes on to say that the new quasi-state of Palestine, quote, shall be responsible for maintaining the security of the compound and for ensuring that it will not be used for any hostile acts against Israelis. In other words, the first and primary task listed for the Palestine security forces in the Al-Haram al-Sharif compound is to protect Israelis. The entire Article 6 about Jerusalem, the entire article is a legitimization of Israel's illegal 67 occupation of East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem was the other thing annexed in 67, not just the West Bank and Gaza. And according to 242, Israel is required to vacate it completely. But after talking exclusively about security in the Old City, specifically, Article 611 talks about the two Jerusalem municipalities, one Palestinian and one Israeli, forming a joint JCDC, a Coordination and Development Committee, to handle things like infrastructure and road repair, all sorts of things. So in other words, the rest of Arab East Jerusalem is just assumed to be Israeli. Only the Old City now is being negotiated in the GA and will generously be offered to the new Palestinian state or a part of it with the restrictions and the multinational policing that's outlined here. The Old City is just a small component. It's an important component, but it's a small one of East Jerusalem. Article 612 strips Palestinian citizens of Israel living in certain parts of Jerusalem of their citizenship outright. Automatically assigns them to the new Palestinian state. It doesn't give them a choice. Article 7 is basically the longest section of the Geneva Accord. It's on refugees, the most contentious issue. Begins by affirming UN Resolution 194 as, quote, the basis for resolving the refugee issue, end quote. But then it insists that this resolution will be fulfilled, just by definition, it will be fulfilled by implementation of the Geneva Accord. Individual choice is affirmed in nice fancy words for Palestinian refugees, but within the constraints outlined in the Geneva Accord, what it calls the options and modalities set forth. But reading on, Israel is granted a complete veto over any Palestinian refugees seeking to return to their homes inside Israel proper, Article 7/4. Thus, the Geneva Accord is, in fact, a direct violation of UN Resolution 194, which it claims forms the basis of the provisions that it's outlining. The Geneva Accord puts an end to all future claims and heavily prescribes the methods and terms and options available to those refugees who might actually avail themselves of its application process. Refugees have 2 years to file their claims, or their limited options that they do get are completely forfeit. And the accord also talks about a compensation and or it has a compensation section where it talks about an international fund to pay for things, to pay for compensation, for lost property, Palestinians lost property, and just for the fact that they've been made refugees in the first place, reparations, basically. Geneva Accord says that Israel will magnanimously contribute to this fund, but we will deduct the value of any property or goods we leave behind in vacated colonies in the new Palestinian state. Article 7/9. Who determines the values? I'm wondering. It's not spelled out. The Geneva Accord also calls for the dismantling of the UNRWA within 5 years. If you can believe that, the UNRWA is the United Nations Refugee Service for Palestine, the single largest humanitarian organization operating in the occupied territories and in the refugee camps of Jordan and Lebanon, which incidentally released a report today calling for international aid and financing to send emergency relief to Gaza, where it says two-thirds of the entire population are in dire poverty and hunger and famine. This threat of all this massive humanitarian crisis. This is the group that Israel wants to get out of there. It's never like the United Nations. There's a lot in this thing. There's no mention of the wall that Jackie talked about. Not a single mention of the wall. No use of even the word occupation. A lot of things are deferred to what's called Annex 10, a lot of the key stuff where you actually would figure out how something's gonna be implemented is deferred to a later to be written section. But the GA basically recycles every old unworkable proposal that Israel and the United States have tried to impose upon the Palestinians during the entire Oslo process up to and including Camp David in July 2000. So it doesn't use the word occupation to describe Israel's military presence in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem. In fact, it pretends that East Jerusalem is simply another neighborhood of Israel's capital and posits that the new area that Israelis must negotiate and make painful concessions around is only the old city. Nor does the Geneva Accord acknowledge Israel's responsibility for the Palestinian refugee crisis, let alone the Nakba, or catastrophe, which was unleashed in 1947-48, and which resulted in the complete destruction of hundreds of Palestinian villages and a series of brutal massacres. No mention of this. Instead, the GA makes a vague reference, Article 7-14-D, to educational and reconciliation programs for, quote, developing appropriate ways of commemorating those villages and communities that existed prior to 1949, end quote. Just think about that. How nice that Palestinians might be able to put up a plaque at the site of Deir Yassin, where hundreds of civilians were massacred in April 48, and where there now sits a quiet Jewish suburb of Jerusalem that's been renamed Givat Shaul. How nice. That's the extent of the acknowledgement of Israeli wrongdoing. The Geneva Accord claims that a sovereign Palestinian state will be created in the West Bank and Gaza, but it will have no army, no control of borders and airspace. It will be a patchwork of barely contiguous cantons, will have no real access to its historic capital, and will still have an Israeli military presence in the Jordan Valley and military outposts in northern and central West Bank. The victory that Palestinian Authority sellouts like Arafat and Rabo are supposed to sell to their own people in this accord is that Palestinians will now have some control over access and policing of the Al-Haram al-Sharif religious compound, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock, you know, one of the most important Islamic holy sites, admittedly. But that's the victory of this accord for the Palestinians, that they're supposed to pretend. They can no longer hide the fact that the core demands of the Palestinian liberation movement have been signed away in principle by elites with zero popular support, and Palestinians are threatening revolt, threatening individuals with violence against the Palestinian Authority. I think it would be foolish to underestimate the possibility of a real civil war within Palestine. And in my opinion, this is probably arguably something that's 10 years past due. It's kind of hard to resist the Israeli occupation when you've got a first fight against your own cronies. The right of return is an individual and human right, not negotiable by anyone other than the refugees themselves. And this has been affirmed by the United Nations 194 specifically, but the principle itself has been generally affirmed and understood in international law and custom for a long time. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Hague Convention, the Fourth Geneva Convention, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And even according to one commentator, there's a principle of right of return that goes all the way back to Magna Carta in 1215. But finally, the GA describes terrorism. It never really defines it, but it describes it solely as a military and security issue, not as a political and diplomatic issue. Throughout the document, it's apparent that the primary task of the Palestinians is to protect and guarantee the security and well-being of Israelis, not the other way around. The Palestinian victims of Israeli occupation are actually assumed to be the criminals. It's they who require monitoring. It's they alone who are to be disarmed. That's the first task of the Palestinian security forces: disarm the people. It's explicitly spelled out. It's they who are expected to allow Israeli inspectors at Palestinian-controlled borders, controlled in quotes, at civilian bus and airport terminals, at mail and cargo depots in their sovereign and inviolable state. The primary task of the Palestinian police force is the same as that under Oslo: disarm and put an end to all irregular forces, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, anybody who gets uppity really and doesn't accept that they should have to put up with a foreign occupation or apartheid. In other words, repress your own people, make sure none of them get crazy ideas about attacking Israel. It's basically the same recipe, in my opinion, for bankruptcy, the same utter capitulation expected from the Palestinians that doomed the Oslo process in the first place and guaranteed only one thing with certainty, and that would be continued Palestinian resistance, continued violence, and obviously a component of that would be continued suicide attacks on Israeli military and civilian targets. That's what I think the Geneva Accord amounts to. I've probably gone on far too long. There's lots that you could talk about, but maybe in the discussion we could talk about, you know, other details or even alternatives. But I'll end there. Thanks.